You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to another edition of the Earth Station DCU! Tonight we're going to be talking Batman number 50, Catwoman number 1, Deathstroke number 33, Justice League number 3, The Man of Steel number 6, and Batman the movie from 1966. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC news. Director James Wan confirms Aquaman trailer will premiere at San Diego Comic-Con.
Yeah, I think we kind of anticipated this because it would be a little concerning, frankly, if there wasn't a trailer ready at that point. It is coming out this year. I am super excited. I have been very, very curious to see what this movie looks like.
I am too. So it's going to be one of those movies that I think it's going to set the tone for what to expect in the future.
I hope so. I hope it's not another one. Well, after this one, it'll be.
Yeah. So I have high hopes for it. So we'll see.
I'm very excited for it. I actually kind of like that we haven't seen anything yet. I would love to have seen something, but I kind of like being in the dark this long. I think it lessens the window for DC to spoil something dumb.
Yes, it does. All right, and for our next bit of DC news, Batman's Anatomy of a Metahuman's coming this September. Do you see that post that was on our Facebook group? It looked pretty interesting.
It looks very interesting. I am very intrigued by this. I will definitely be checking it out.
It's basically Batman's take on metahumans and, you know, what he thinks of each metahuman, so, and what their powers are and stuff. So it'll be really interesting.
The artwork is really what's drawing me to it. It just looks very cool.
Yeah, it really does. It looks pretty crisp.
Yeah.
All right, and for our last bit of DC news, we're sad to hear the passing of legendary artist and creator Steve Ditko, who's basically best known for co-creating Spider-Man, but he also ushered in a slew of other unique characters, especially for DC, including The Question and Blue Beetle, which when he was at Charlton before they came over to DC, Hawk and Dove, the Atom, and, you know, there's more of them out there.
Yeah, I was very bummed to hear this. He is extremely influential in the history of superhero comics. Oftentimes, Kirby is the one that people focus on as the one that was Stan Lee's major partner, which he was. But Ditko is right up there, too. I mean, Spider-Man, you know, I mean, one of the biggest comic book characters of all time. And it's just, he bears a large responsibility for what that character became.
Very true. All right, well, that wraps up DC News for this week. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Okay, auditions for the new Earth Station Who co-host. Take one, go ahead.
Hello, Stonehenge. Who takes the Pandora Cup, takes the universe. But, bad news everyone, cause guess who? Ha, listen, you lot you're all whizzing about. It's really very distracting. Could you all just stay still a minute because I am talking?
Not too shabby. Can you close this up?
Earth Station Who, a fun mashup celebrating over 50 years of the Doctor Who universe. You never know where the TARDIS is going to go next. Earth Station Who podcast can be found at www.earthstationwho.com. Earth Station Who is a proud member of the ESO Network. We are up on Facebook, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or wherever fine podcasts are found. Peace and we are done. Did I pass the audition?
We'll get back to you. Next.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. For you.
All right, let's talk Batman number 50. And joining us tonight is Howdy Mike Gordon. He's going to join us for issues Batman number 50 and Catwoman number 1.
Howdy. I'm actually caught up on something, so I can join you for new release talk.
All right, Batman number 50. Okay, guys.
All right, so I just want to start off with, were you guys satisfied with this issue?
No.
No, I can't say overall I was satisfied completely with this issue. There, I do have a couple. I could see it coming what they were doing, but ultimately I'm not happy. I'm not as content. I think it could have been done better.
I agree. I think story wise, it makes sense with the story that Tom King is telling, but DC kind of, I think, shot themselves in the foot with the way that they sold it, and then also with the way that they built this issue. So they sold it for months as the wedding issue. So right there, you're building people's expectations when you didn't need to. Like, if you knew that this was the outcome, don't bill it. Like, it's just, don't push it as hard as they push it, I guess, is what I'm saying. Don't make it as big of an event. Because I still think they are going to get married, but then they're going to make that another event. And people, I think it's going to have less excitement because people are like, oh, you're going to do this again. So I think they messed up there. And then the second thing, like I mentioned, was the way they actually built the issue. If they're not going to get married, I don't want 2/3 of the comic being taken up with commemorative artwork for something that's not happening. Yeah, I mean, like, the drawings were all fantastic, but ultimately they're for nothing. Like, they're celebrating a relationship that, as of now, is not fulfilled. And so I think that, to me, that was a waste. If you're going to use all of those sort of splash pages, to just let them get married, man. Like, if you're not gonna have them get married, then focus the issue on actually telling that story. That's what I would have wanted.
I have to tell you, those splash pages, I did not like them in the middle of the story. Every time I got to one, it irritated me that I wasn't reading the story.
Well, I don't know. I didn't feel that way. I thought they were, first of all, I thought they were all beautiful.
I agree.
And yes, it does kind of take you out of it because you're like, you know, reading the story and all of a sudden, whoa, that's beautiful. Oh, there's words. Let me see if I can, okay, read those. Okay. And obviously, you know, we're reading their letters to each other, which I thought was, you know, well put together. Once it's done, I think, and I agree to the point where, you know, you make this big announcement and you're selling this thing. It's the wedding issue, et cetera, and then, you know, the end result is they don't get married. You know, it's not some plot by the Joker showing up and doing something insane. It's more underhanded than that. It does sort of. I know a lot of people were, you know, left not satisfied and angry, even and more so. So, I do think, you know, and I found that, you know, I think articles now with King are, he's spending a lot of time going, no, this is not the whole story. Like, it's not like there's more that we're telling. So stay tuned. Like so he's had to kind of, you know, be an apologist for this, which, you know, The issue itself might not have been might been okay doing this the way they did it, but to have us buy, what was it, 5-6 issues prelude to the wedding, that's where you kind of go, well, now what the hell did I do that for?
Right. I tend to think that this was more DC's marketing. I would blame them more for this than King, because he has said this on multiple occasions before the big hubbub about this issue, that he was planning on telling a basically 100-issue story with Batman and Catwoman. So that's not new. So I do think that this was sort of planned as a sort of midpoint. And so then you sort of have to look at, okay, well, then how was it marketed? Don't market it that. Like, you set DC, I think, set themselves up for this kind of backlash. If you just let it come out as issue 50, people are still going to go for it, because, you know, big round numbers like that are always something that people want to get. But if you just market it as the next issue of Batman, which, by the way, is selling extremely well, you don't really need to push it that much more. I don't know that there's that much of a outcry about it. I think more people would just read the issue and be like, oh, okay, well, that's not really what I wanted, but I think more people would be open to seeing where it goes. Whereas when you sort of sell them this snake oil, they're very hesitant to jump back in.
I could tell you, after reading this issue, I was disappointed. I was kind of depressed after reading it the day I read it, because I read it first thing Wednesday morning when it came out. I downloaded it right away, and I drove to work, got there a little early, sat in my car, and I just read the sucker. And by the time I was done with it, I was like, just in this depression.
Oh man. Because
I was very disappointed. I was so hyped for it, and then I was disappointed in the ending. And oh man. But with the artwork in between the story, that irritated me. I didn't mind the artwork, but I preferred it to be at the end of the issue instead of spread in between the story. I didn't really care for that. And it kind of took me out of the story. Especially reading the poetry kind of letters to each other. I don't know. I just would have preferred it at the end of the issue and just let me read the whole story first instead of it, you know, keep bouncing into my story.
I can definitely see that. And I didn't feel the same way, but I definitely can see that. And to be honest with you, I was not surprised that they didn't get married, because the seeds were set, right? First of all, Catwoman is not getting her own title if they're together. I'm kind of like, okay, so well, that the solicitations for that kind of spoil that too. But also, you know, in the issues right before this, where the Joker and the Catwoman are having a great talk, and he says, you know, I'm doing this because he can't be, you know, I'm trying to save Batman. Like, the Joker's like, I'm trying to save Batman because you're trying to take him away, because if he's happy, then, you know, it's he's not going to be Batman. He can't be Batman and be happy at the same time. So I'm doing what's best for everybody. And Catwoman kind of goes, huh. And I'm like, okay, there's the seed right there. Right. It's like, it's placed right there. Then in this issue, you have Holly doing the same thing. And I thought, okay, that's really telling. And then the last, like, sort of the end panel with Holly approaching Bane, and then the rogues are all standing around, and I'm thinking, okay, now wait a minute. So now you're telling me that Holly did it at the behest of Bane, and the Joker did too? And I'm like, okay, I can buy Holly, although for those of us who really like that character, that's kind of an insult, that Holly betrays Selina that way. I don't know if she's been used. I just remember her from, like, the whose run was that? Was that the Brubaker run of Catwoman? She was just a good figure there, and she just wouldn't, like, I'm like, why did you have her betray her? That doesn't make any sense, and it's kind of insulting to that character. Plus, I kind of thought they cut out the legs of the Joker too, because I'm like, the Joker's working for Bane. I'm like, that doesn't, like, wash with me either.
Okay, my biggest question from that scene is, what was Gotham Girl doing there?
And Thomas Wayne, apparently. Well, it seems to be Thomas Wayne.
Yeah, because there's, like, another Batman there. I'm like, who's that dude?
I'll admit, I did not. The first time I watched it, I was too consumed with the whole disappointment that the two didn't get married that I really only saw Bane. And then the second time I looked at it again, I was like, oh, wait, Gotham Girl's there? Oh, wait. Batman from the Flashpoint universe is there. What's going on?
Yeah, that panel was the problematic thing that I had. Like, that was that one panel was the problem for me. Like, I think I could have made it out if they had just erased that panel. I think I would have been okay with the issue as a whole and continuing the story on, outside of all the hype and everything like that. But that panel made me just question everything that King is doing, because I'm like, all right, I understand that Bane is a mastermind or whatever and he's trying to get back at him, but I am not buying this, like, because I'm like, where are they supposed to be? Are they at Arkham? Because why is Holly in Arkham? Like, I'm like, I don't understand what's going on here.
I'm pretty sure she was in the run earlier at some point because Batman helped Selina track her down because Holly had gone on a murder spree.
Yeah. And I didn't remember that.
Yeah, that they did. Batman and Catwoman, because Bruce, if you remember right, Bruce had to prove Selina's innocence in the murder.
That's right.
So that's why she was there.
And then I thought I was confused too, because that in issue 50 is the first time I think they mention, oh, it's not Bruce and Selina, it's Batman and Catwoman. Because Bruce and Selina can't get married. And I'm like, wait, is this something that we had heard before?
Yes. Yes, we did hear it before. It was in one of the pre-wedding.
Multiple. Right, but it wasn't in but it wasn't in King's story.
No.
See, that's what confused me, because I did read the prelude ones, but I was like, but as far as King's story, because when I read it in the prelude, I'm like, is that right? Is that what they're doing? Because that seems weird. But
actually, it makes perfect sense. Cletus and I talked about this a few episodes ago, that Batman and Catwoman getting married instead of Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle. I mean, too many people know Selina Kyle's Catwoman.
It also fits King's run, too, because the two of them refer to each other as Bat and Cat.
Yeah.
Not as Bruce and Selina.
Although it did seem like, I was wondering what they were doing then. Are they making it legal, but just not publicizing it? Because they got, like, he stole a judge. And I'm like, okay, why would you need a judge?
That's
even though he's highly inebriated.
Like, that's because
it's really going to hold up.
They decided to elope, basically, without doing the big. They decided to do it early.
Yeah, but why do you need a judge? Why not have Alfred do it? If it's just in ceremony only, just have Alfred do it.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know either.
like, why are you stealing a guy? Like, I'm just like, why are you kidnapping a guy, a judge, and why do you need a judge at all? It seemed to be very unlike Bruce. Like, Bruce is so controlling. Like, you know, everything has to be this, this, and this. He does his homework. He looks into people. Like, I just thought that, I don't know. It'll be really interesting to see what 51 is like. And is Bruce going to be angry? Or is he, starting to break as Bane wants him to? Or what's going on?
See, now, I actually think what the things you mentioned with it not kind of seeming right with what he's doing go into why I think that this was intended as a false start, because it's not quite right. It's really rushed. Like you said, like, why are you getting a judge? That's not necessary. And all of it kind of feels really sloppy. To me, all of that felt like the messed up first attempt. And I do anticipate that they will get married, like issue 100, I think, is what's ultimately going to end up happening. So I'm going to be very curious to see how that story continues. Because I don't know. I mean, maybe they're just doing damage control, but I am convinced that we really are at the halfway point with this story.
And that could be true. But I mean, for something that they're just going to elope with, you have like this. Yeah, you're right. Because they have this 5-issue series that acts like it's going to be a big ceremony with everybody invited.
Right. And that's all that stuff that you. Again, I think if you had just let this issue, if it was just issue 50, and like you said, you don't have those tie-ins, which I agree were totally unnecessary. You don't make the big fanfare with this. You just write issue 50. I would not have a problem at all with the story. My thing was how you build it and how you sold it, how you wrote it based around it, them actually getting married and then not doing it. Like, if you're not going to do it, don't do it. That's fine. Just write issue 50.
Yeah.
Yeah, that basically sums it up right there. All right, let's move on to Catwoman number 1. So this issue basically opens up with Catwoman after she's, you know, after leaving Batman at the altar, she's left Gotham, which makes perfect sense. And we see her gambling her troubles away.
Man, when she gets the package from Alfred with her costume in it, that was heartbreaking.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I just say too, for all the negative or whatever you feel about the issue 50 of Batman and all the crap that might have been involved with that, you know, talking about some good coming out of it, this is a very good first issue of Catwoman. Like,
I totally agree.
Maybe one of the best issues of Catwoman I've read in a long time. Like, see, I'm blanking on her name now.
Joel Jones,
right. Is as the writer and the artist, it's just, she has a vision of Selina that sort of matches what I think it's the best part of Selina. And, the art is fantastic. It's such a good read.
I agree. Andrew will attest to this. I have been saying for what is about 2 months now, ever since they announced the title, that this is the perfect creator for Catwoman. I mean, she is, if you look at her Lady Killer stuff, the quality in this issue is exactly what I expected, because, I mean, in a lot of ways, there's a lot of Catwoman in Lady Killer, just like, you know, the characteristics. And it was great. I was not let down at all. She totally met my expectations for this issue.
Yeah.
This is really good. And I was surprised with the villain, Mrs. Creel, how we saw her on camera as the governor's wife. And then when she gets away from the camera and takes off all that makeup, how crazy she looked.
I actually think that's one of Joel Jones' strong suits, and you see it a few times in her Lady Killer series. She's so good at drawing people that just look that sort of like really beautiful, frankly beautiful, and that sort of like a little, especially in Lady Killer, that sort of 50s aesthetic. But then she can also like counter that hard with somebody that's just truly revolting, and it makes it stick out even more because you're used to these gorgeous people that she draws. And then you get somebody like this character that's terrifying. It's great. I mean, the contrast works so well.
I am so curious. Why is she hiring a fake Catwoman?
Well, or Catwomen, as it turns out.
I was going to say, like, there's more than one. that's the mystery, right? I mean, we don't know. We'll find out. So I'm intrigued. Like, why do they need all these Catwomen? Like, and it is a great cliffhanger. It is an awesome, amazing cliffhanger. Like, when she opens that door and there's a bunch of them, it's like, whoa, I did not see that coming.
A bunch of copycats.
One of the things I really appreciated about this issue was how it just went for it. It just started telling the story. I think a lot of times number one suffer a lot from trying to set up the foundation for the entire run. And in doing so, they forget to tell a good story for the first issue. I don't think this issue suffers from that at all. I think Joel Jones does a great job of just hits the ground running and just starts telling her story.
Yeah, and they do a great job of showing Catwoman's sadness of having to leave Bruce, you know, thinking that that's what she needed to do to keep him as Batman.
But then also not lingering on it, too. That's the other thing I like. It's clearly Catwoman's story. It's not Batman's story told through Catwoman's eyes. And that's something not all Catwoman stories have been good at doing.
I agree with you. All right. Any last thoughts on Catwoman before we move on?
I'm looking forward to more.
Agree. I totally agree. This was great.
Yeah, I am too.
Yeah. Anybody who doesn't like, you know, what happened with the wedding or whatever, read, like, there is good in this. Like, no matter what Tom King is doing, read what Jones is doing.
All right. Well, we appreciate you joining us for those, reviewing those two issues, Mike.
Absolutely. It was fun. Hang out with you guys. Talking comics. I love it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, we'll have to do this again.
Absolutely.
All right, let's move on to Deathstroke number 33. After a confusing issue by Priest, not because...
We follow up with another confusing issue by Priest.
I know. It's not because the story is bad, but...
It's just confusing. I just don't like, just tell the story straightforward. I don't understand why he's doing this sort of memento jumping back and forth, playing with time. It's unnecessary. Like, especially in this one, we start with Damian and Deathstroke on a mission, and then it jumps back to what leads to them going on a mission together. I'm like, but what was the point of that? Like, why do that?
I got to tell you, I was confused why they, when I started reading the opening of this issue, I was like, why are they talking like Damian and Deathstroke? At first I thought it was two different people because they didn't look like them. And then I finally figured out, oh, they're in disguises.
Yeah, I don't understand. It's just, we talked about this last week. Priest gets a little too cute with his stuff, and I don't get why. Like, if he just wrote the story straightforward, sure, I guess, yes, they'd be a little less unique, I guess, but they'd also be way easier to understand. Like, this issue, I am not enjoying this story that much, in large part because it is so hard to understand what is going on.
Yeah, it really is. And what I got out of this issue is Robin basically goes along with Deathstroke being his father just to figure out what he's up to.
But acknowledges that the test was faked.
Yeah.
And that's what I didn't understand, is that he acknowledges, and this is one of the many things I was confused about, he acknowledges that the test is faked, but then he continues to like play along as if Destro really is his dad anyway. And I just was like, what is going on? The only thing I got for sure out of this was that Deathstroke and Damian teamed up for reasons that are not entirely clear to me. And then Deathstroke seemed to figure out that Alfred and Wintergreen were up to something. And I still don't understand why Alfred and Wintergreen are up to something either.
Yeah, so. I don't understand it either. And I think the next issue of this is the last one, and I'll be happy that it's wrapping up.
I was confused by that too, because didn't it say it was the end in a two-parter though?
Did it?
I can't remember. Maybe I'm misremembering it, but even that, I was like, what? That's two issues then, Priest. That's not how that works.
I don't know. But I'll be happy when we get to the end of it. They say, yes, Damian is Bruce's son. Let's move on.
I mean, because like we've talked about before, if they do change it, first off, this book is not getting enough fanfare for that. There will be countless people that will all of a sudden be like, wait, what are you talking about? And secondly, there's no point. Damian as a character, there's no point in him existing unless he's Batman's son.
Right.
We already have a son of Deathstroke that can act as that sort of assassin son. Just bring him back from the dead. There you go.
Right. All right, let's move on to Justice League number 3. And I did like how this opened. Before he was Green Lantern, we learned that Thal Sinestro was an intergalactic anthropologist. I thought that was pretty cool.
That's consistent with what they've shown with him before. They've shown that a few times before where he's, I think even actually in Sinestro's original one, he is exploring ruins when he comes across the Green Lantern and gets his ring.
Okay, I don't remember seeing that before, so.
As someone who wrote their master's thesis on him, I have a lot of, some might say useless knowledge of Sinestro, but I say very valuable knowledge.
So we see Sinestro has found the invisible spectrum in this, and we see that he wants to keep it locked up.
But, so that was one thing I was a little unclear, was that so he locked it up in the past, and then when we get to the end of the issue, he says that that's what he was trying to do when he went back, was lock it up again, and then it got out, but it seemed like he was okay with it, and so it was unclear to me whether he was under the control of this like John was, or he changed his mind. I didn't get what happened there.
My take on it is he changed his mind when he found out that it was going to attack Earth, because basically I think he saw this as his chance to be rid of Earth and its heroes.
That makes sense. It just wasn't quite clear, because he's like, yeah, no, actually I was going to go seal it up again, and then I didn't.
Yeah, okay. Which made sense to me that he wouldn't want it out there, even though he's a villain.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I mean, Sinestro's always been that sort of walking that line very closely between hero and villain.
Yeah, but
at least within the last 15 years or so.
And when he saw that it was going to actually help him defeat Earth's heroes, I think he was like, okay, I'll hang on. Let's take care of this first.
Yeah, which is definitely something Sinestro would do.
Well, we learn a lot more about this invisible spectrum in this. We find out that the invisible spectrum Its heart is a living phantom galaxy powered by a sentient black sun called Umbrox. It's kind of hard to fathom exactly what it is, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely out there.
Yeah.
Very cool. I feel like Snyder has something so interesting with this Lantern story. I kind of wish he would just not have told this other one that's going on with Superman and Martian Manhunter, not because it's good. That is also good, and that's sort of the problem. Like, I'd rather have each of them have their own issue.
So you can focus on one instead of trying to... It's like there's three different stories going on at the same time.
Well, it is so much. Dude, the problem is it's so much. It's not like he's telling these two good stories, but they're kind of simple stories. They're very complex, like we just talked about. Like, this whole idea with this almost sentient lantern force is very interesting, but very complex. I think it just needs more space to stretch its legs out.
I agree with you. I felt the same way. I was like, man, this is packed full of different stories going on, because we basically had three different stories going on in this issue.
Yeah.
And they are complex. It's going to take a while. If they keep telling all three of them at the same time, it's going to take a while to get them told.
That's the thing, though. I don't know that they will. I kind of feel like they're going to end up ending abruptly a little bit and not having quite as much of a satisfying ending as they could as if they had gotten a full few issues to tell their stories. I don't know. I kind of feel like we're headed towards some sort of almost like, you know, first volume ending within the next couple issues.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I just have that feeling. I'm not saying that's what I want, but that's what it feels like. And I feel like if we had just given the first five to just Sinestro, I'd be fine with that. And yeah. It can be, like, you can have it tie into the Legion of Doom. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it should be Sinestro and only Sinestro, but if you have it as, like, just Sinestro's plot as a part of what the Legion of Doom is doing, and then towards the end of that story, you start to transition into the Superman, Martian Manhunter one, I personally would like that just a little bit better. I think it would do justice to both stories more, because they're both good. I like both stories.
I do, too. So, in the other story we have, the totality is, it's trying to de-evolve the creatures that Superman and Martian Manhunter are fighting. And they're even trying to devolve Superman and Martian Manhunter themselves. I think I remember it saying that.
Yeah, that's what Hawkgirl and Batman are doing inside. Those two are fighting off the things that would devolve those Superman and Martian Manhunter.
Now, they eventually come across some other creatures that they said it was similar to the ones that had been stuck in the Source Wall.
And yeah, it looks exactly like the Source Wall.
And when John reaches out to him with his mind, we find out they're basically another defense of the totality.
And it hints that he sees something, but it didn't. I don't think it really told us what it was.
No. And were you surprised to see the Joker in there with Hawkgirl?
Yes, but it made sense. Like, yeah. I thought that it was one of those things that Snyder immediately did a good job explaining how he got in there. And I was like, that's awesome. So yeah. I was both surprised and I was pleased that it made complete sense story-wise as well.
Yeah. So I'm curious to see how that's going to end. Then the third story we got going on, we have Wonder Woman, Flash, and Aquaman, and they're investigating a nowhere zone in the ocean where, according to Aquaman, all life is supposed to be toxic there. But then they find a building where the design looks Amazonian but has old Atlantean technology, which they didn't come out and say it, but I'm guessing that's the Legion of Doom's headquarters. Is that what you got?
I'm not sure. There was so much going on, man. That was my thing.
But the other interesting thing with this part of the story is they find these tombs with animalistic-looking white Martians that attack them. So I was intrigued by that, too.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we get to the end of this issue where we learn that Umbrax has come to Earth. And that's where they left this issue. A lot of interesting stuff going on, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
All right, well, let's move on to our last title for this week, Man of Steel number 6.
Remember our great discussion on Man of Steel number 5 last podcast?
Yes. Okay. I'm editing. All right. I got to let the audience know. I was editing episode 105. I got to our discussion on Man of Steel number 5 where it was supposed to be at, and I realized I accidentally skipped over it, and Cletus and I ended up not talking about it at all.
We can assure you it was not because we did not enjoy the issue or that we didn't read it, because we definitely read it and then just promptly forgot to say anything about it.
I even had it in my notes, so I don't know what happened. Oh, man, that was my goof up.
I didn't notice either. When Drew mentioned this to me the first time, I was like, what do you mean? We didn't talk about it? Because I just, in my head, because I had read the issue, in my head we had talked about it.
Yeah, and I thought we had talked about it too. And I'm editing and I'm like, wait a minute, Man of Steel number 5 was supposed to be next. Where did it go? And then I thought, okay, well maybe we ended up talking about it out of order and I didn't realize it. And then I finish editing the episode, no Man of Steel number 5. I'm like, oops. But anyways, in this issue, it opens up with Clark, Lois, and John and Jor-El discussing whether John can go with Jor-El to see the wonders of the galaxy. Because in Man of Steel number 5, we learn why Jor-El had come. He wants to take John on a trip through the galaxy. He wants to spend some time with him, basically.
Yeah, and in the previous issue, John also states that he wants to go.
Right.
Yeah, and so I really liked the kind of mini family conflict that they have there, where Superman is very understandably extremely reluctant to let Jor-El take Jonathan, which I would be too, because, I mean, look how warped Jor-El has become. Like, Superman does not want his son to become like that. But then you have the counter argument that Jonathan has, where he's like, look what I potentially could become in the future. I don't want to become that. Let me do this.
Right. And I think it was very smart of Lois to decide to go with him.
I agree. I also, the coolest thing I think I saw in there is that Superman gives her a suit. I am 100% sure that we're going to see Lois show up in a Superman suit. Similar to what we saw in Superwoman, hopefully with a little more satisfaction than what we got.
No kidding.
That. But I'm very much looking forward to that scene because I guarantee it's going to happen at some point.
I wonder if we're going to get to follow any of their adventures in through the galaxy.
You know, honestly, that was a question I had too. I don't know that we will, but I would definitely like to read that. Feels like what you could... At some point, Action Comics is coming back, right?
Yeah.
Don't you think that that's what Action Comics could be?
That would be awesome if Action Comics was that.
I don't know if that's what they're going to do or not, but that would be great.
So, and I know we've got Superman number 1 coming out next week, so I'm guessing the week after we get an Action Comics. I don't know. I haven't seen anything about it yet, so that'll be interesting to see. Now, were you surprised to find out that Perry actually fired Lois?
Not really, because Perry has been known to be a little bit of a hothead. I also don't think that he really meant it. You know what I mean? Like how J. Jonah used to fire Spider-Man, but not really need to fire him.
Yeah.
That's how it felt to me. It didn't feel like Perry was legitimately firing her.
So, we know she's going to be gone for a while, but I could see her easily getting her job back at the...
Oh, she'll definitely get her job back. I am not worried in the slightest about her job security. She didn't seem to be either, so...
All right, let's talk about Rogol Zaar, because my guess is Clark's head is not where it needs to be, because he is not making some good decisions about Rogol Zaar. We have Supergirl... who actually takes some actions against him and uses the Phantom Zone projector to send him to the Phantom Zone.
I actually really like that it was essentially Supergirl that saved the day.
I did
that
too.
That was awesome. I mean, because he's Superman has not quite yet started to lose to Rogol Zaar, but he even says, like in the sort of running monologue, that he's about to start losing. Like he's not going to be able to handle him much longer. And then Supergirl comes out of nowhere to save him. And then she's the one that thinks to use the Phantom Zone, Which I do agree. Superman mentions that that's only a temporary solution, that it doesn't really fix the problem, which I agree with. However, when you're losing to this guy straight up, that, I mean, that really is the best option, basically to give yourself a timeout to figure out what to do.
Yeah, Supergirl is the one who's being smart here, and I think the thing with Jor-El has really got him upset, where he's not thinking straight.
That, and then also Kandor getting destroyed, and that blindsiding him so completely, that I think the two of those things really just have him off his game.
Yeah, I agree. Now, and then I do like the fact that Supergirl declares that she's leaving Earth to go on a mission to learn more about Rogol Zaar. And I believe that story is going to be going on in Supergirl.
That's cool.
So we might end up picking up Supergirl to follow that story, because I'm interested in it.
This story does act as a really good sort of lead-in to the run. I do think this is actually going to be a rare case where the trade of this will be a little bit unsatisfying. Well, if you buy this alone, like, let's say I'm saying like 5 years down the road, you're in a bookstore or a comic book store and you're looking for a Superman trade you haven't read before, but you pick this up, I don't think you're going to find the ending of this very satisfying at all. I think this really has to, you have to then read the story that comes after that. I don't know what that story is going to be exactly, but this by itself will not be a satisfying story.
Agreed, because you get to the end of it and all you want to do is find out more, and you have to get this trade, and this trade.
Yeah. Now, I don't want that to sound like I'm criticizing this, because I very much enjoyed it, but nonetheless, it definitely does not stand on its own. It's very much like part one of a new story.
Yeah, a very interesting story.
Yeah.
All right, let's get to the end of this issue. How surprised were you when we get to that last scene with the new fire chief, and that boy comes in and claims that Superman's starting the fires?
I wouldn't say surprised, more like dubious. Like, I don't think that it's actually him. And if it is him, I don't know that that's a story that I want to, like, I don't know. If it really is him setting it, you've got to come up with something very interesting for how he would be that unaware that somebody's clearly, obviously controlling him to do that, and how he would be unaware of that. But unaware of that, but then still able to be in control long enough to fight Rogol Zaar.
See, I have a feeling that it's some sort of doppelganger of some sort.
Exactly. So that's why I said I'm either dubious that it's really him, or if it is him, I'm dubious at how that happened.
So, yeah, my first thought was doppelganger. So, all right,
Bizarro. Well, that would be interesting.
Yeah, that was one thing I was wondering if it was Bizarro.
No, it probably wouldn't be though, because he's in Red Hood, or not Red Hood. I'm sorry. Red Hood. So I was getting him and Red Arrow mixed up. he's in that Red Hood and the Outlaws.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And unless Bendis just gives the middle finger to that that creator, I'm pretty sure he wouldn't just steal Bizarro like that.
No, it could be something else. It could even be like Cyborg Superman or something. Who knows? Well, we'll find out. All right, well, that wraps up our comic book talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk Batman the movie.
Okay, let's talk about the Flopcast.
Where every week we drink a lot of coffee, and we talk about comic books,
movies,
conventions,
music,
Saturday morning cartoons.
Oh, don't forget the coffee.
Lots of weird, obscure pop culture stuff from the 70s and 80s.
And chickens. Yeah, chickens.
This will be the stupidest half hour of your week.
We guarantee it.
You can find us on the ESO Network.
And Flopcast.net.
And we're back. Let's talk Batman the movie from 1966. So we're going back in time a little ways here. And joining us tonight, all the way from the main station, is Howdy Mike Gordon.
Howdy. I'm glad to be back in this part of the state. Man, you guys are really doing things up over here.
Yes, we are.
It's got that 100 episode plus smell now.
Yes, we've gone over the hump.
Excellent. Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's came pretty quick, actually.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. And let me say, like, when people say, "Oh, you've been doing this for how many years?" I'm like, "Whoa!" I have to figure it out, and I'm like, 400 and some episodes. Yeah, that's crazy. But good job, guys. So, and I'm sure, as you found out, there's just no end to the things you can talk about. It's just as far as DC Comics.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's always tons of stuff to talk about, which is cool. So, and you know, I love talking DC stuff, so it's easy. All right, well, let's get into the movie here. Let's start off by talking about, when was the first time you saw this?
Oh, man. see, I grew up on the show. I mean, I do remember watching, not as it aired. I'm not that old. Although, I'm not, yeah, it's close. But I saw the original Batman series in syndication. And, you know, I would run home and watch it every afternoon. Loved it, loved it, loved it. I'm not sure if I was aware that there was a movie. I couldn't tell you. Yeah, it just kind of all blends in for me, because I don't think I saw the movie first. I think I saw the series, and then at some point I watched the movie.
All right, all I can tell you, I did not know about the movie either until I believe they released it in, I think it was 89. Yeah, that's right. They did a release of it in 89, because the new Batman movie in 1989 came out with Tim Burton's movie. And they re-released that original movie, and that's when I first saw it. I got it on VHS. Now, I was aware of the television show when I was 5. I remember watching it in the afternoons. And it was my first introduction to Batman. I loved the show, and that's what got me into superheroes. That's what got me into comics.
I think today might have been the first time I saw it all the way through. I'm not gonna lie. All the way back in 2018, I remember it well. I've for sure seen clips of this movie, and I may have. It may have been on TV at some point, and I saw part of it, because some parts seemed a little familiar, but I cannot remember sitting all the way through it before.
For the longest time, the movie was all that people had, right? Because for a while, the legal rights to distribute the TV series were hung up between a battle between Warner Brothers and Fox, and they just weren't making any headway either way. But the movie, on the other hand, could be released and was released by Fox, and was available on DVD, was available, channels were showing it, it was showing in some retro theaters, et cetera, et cetera. So for the longest time, if you wanted a Batman 66 fix, it was the movie. And so a lot of the imagery from the movie are what a lot of people will cling to and remember. A lot of the sequences that I'm sure we'll talk about, people think we're on the show, but we're actually in the movie.
All right. Well, this movie came out in 1966, and it actually aired between season 1 and season 2.
That's interesting, because I was wondering, as I was watching it, because I don't know. So I was like, I wonder when this came out, if this came out when the show was done or what. Okay, that's cool to know.
Yeah, and I did a little bit of research. I found out it premiered at the Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas on July 30th, 1966. And like I said, it was between the first and second seasons. And it had a moderately successful box office. Some of the things that were featured in this film that weren't in the television series was the Bat Boat, the helicopter, and the Bat Cycle. They were all new to the film.
Yeah, they got some money.
Yep.
I did get that impression when they showed off the Bat helicopter. I was like, this seems like something that was a big sort of like surprise.
And there was a lot more exterior shots. A lot more exterior shots.
Gotcha.
Well, the cast of this movie was fairly the same as from the television show. Most of the actor and actresses reprised their roles in this for this movie. And I think one of the changes I can think of was Lee Merriweather as Catwoman.
Yeah, Julie Newmar wasn't available when they were shooting, so they had to do something else. So it's one of the first times in the series or in the franchise that they actually change up an actor in a role.
Right, and I believe that didn't Julie Newmar come back and do some more Catwoman in season two?
Yes, she did.
That's what I thought. She did.
And then she was not available, I think, season three, and that's when they switched to Eartha Kitt.
The other thing that was different about this movie is you had four supervillains teaming up in this, and that was something we didn't really have in the show.
No, this was big. I mean, it's a big deal to have. I mean, even it is in the comics, right? I mean, it's a big deal if you get two supervillains or villains, you know, combining their forces. But for, you know, the four main ones, that was pretty outstanding.
Yeah, so this movie for me anyways, I find it hilarious, and it's just great to watch over and over and over again. I got to see it for the first time on the big screen this past Saturday, and I was so excited to see it. Not that I haven't seen it a gazillion times before, but it was great to see it on the big screen.
I bet. So, I don't know that I've ever seen it on the big screen. I can't recall that if I have. So if I did, it was in college.
So I was happy to see it on the big screen, because before I'd only seen it on VHS. And it's actually been a while since I've actually watched this. Since this is the first time you'd seen it through, Cletus, what were your thoughts on the movie?
It was exactly what I expected out of the movie. It was great. I mean, I really enjoyed it. It was very tongue-in-cheek. I liked a lot of the sort of subtle humor, a lot of the sort of the things that they would kind of hint at, but not, you know, kind of like wink at you a little bit. Then there was just some of those, like, they were like sort of like throwaway lines I thought were the funniest, like when Penguin dehydrates all of his minions and he and Catwoman are scooping him up. He's like, be careful, they all have mothers.
Yeah. Everyone's got a mother.
That line just cracked me up, because it's such a concerned line, and yet he just basically reduced all of those guys to ash. Like, it was great.
There's so many funny moments in this movie. One of my favorite scenes from this movie is the one where Batman can't get rid of a bomb. Some days you just can't get rid of a bomb.
I think it is the most classic scene of, some would say, of the whole franchise, really.
I do think it encapsulates the series really well. I mean, it killed me. I mean, because the nuns kept coming back, that band kept coming around.
Dun, 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 dun. I can hear that band right now.
Exactly.
Oh, man. And the ducks.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. That guy, I killed me too, and he almost throws it in and he sees the ducks, but he was fine with the sea life throwing themselves in front of the torpedoes earlier.
Well, they didn't have a choice with that.
Oh, yeah. No, it was their heroic sacrifice is what saved them. So
exactly.
Talking about heroic sacrifices, we talked about this last week briefly, Cletus, when Brandon threw up his scenario about Batman 66 and Miller's Dark Knight, Frank Miller's Dark Knight. Remember when we talked about that briefly?
Yeah.
This is a perfect example of what I was talking about. Like the porpoises taking that torpedo. And there was one other one in the movie. I'm trying to think what it was. But, you know, it's just circumstances that happened to save Batman.
Oh, when the helicopter lands on the foam rubber convention.
Yes.
But just happened to be there.
Yeah. Ridiculous stuff like that. I find that hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, I really appreciate Lorenzo Semple Jr., who wrote many of the first season episodes, as well as this movie. He also did the 80s movie version of Flash Gordon. And I love his writing because he really gets, like, camp, you know? And I will say some of the stuff in the movie, more than the show, goes a little bit too much over the top. Maybe played a little too much for laughs, but overall the tone is still there. But yeah, some of the things where it's like, you know, you just kind of groan. You're like, oh yeah, the porpoise, you know, or oh yeah, the foam thing. It's just like really, like come on, like I mean, at least in the show they try to cleverly, you know, get out of the cliffhangers that they're in. These seem to be very, very, very in your face, like coincidences, you know?
Yeah, it really felt like they went in hard on the just absolute absurd as far
yeah,
as the
yeah, ability absolutely. To escape. And the ending, you know, the ending where they switch up, you know, accidentally switch up all the delegates in terms of their personalities with their bodies. And then they just kind of go, you know, avoid eye contact, let's just slip out the window. Like, it's just, like, I'm like, you know, like, they're all up arguing, and Batman and Robin are just kind of sneak out, like, do-do-do-do-do, don't mind us, you know? And it's, I don't know, that, to be honest, I'm still not sure I'm satisfied with that ending, you know?
Oh, okay. That was the thing I wanted to ask you guys about the most when I watched it, because I felt like the ending it was just sort of there. Like I was like, and then the movie ended. I was like, well, that was a weird ending, because it felt really slow. You have the kind of big climax on the submarine, and I understand there needs to be a little bit of, you know, coming down from that, but it felt like it dragged on a little bit, and then just sort of, I don't know, it was odd. It fit in that it continued to be ridiculous, but it felt like the movie needed to keep going, but they ran out of stuff to write.
Yeah, well, I think in some ways, yeah, that might be true. But I think especially since right before that, while they're putting them together, Robin suggests, like, why don't we tweak them, Batman, so that, you know, that they'll get along or whatever. And Batman's like, no, we can't do that because that's pretty much dishonest, whatever. That's not the right thing to do. And they end up doing it anyway. And I mean, but accidentally, of course, but still. You know, and then once it happens, Batman's like, well, this might be for the best, Robin. Like he's laying claim to it. And it just, like, it kind of was insincere, like, because Batman on the show is always played straight up as if he's, like, the guy. And there's not really any second-guessing him, so to speak. So I thought in the movie there was a little bit more of a leeway with, you know, how ridiculous he is sometimes.
Yeah.
So I also thought it's kind of funny. I don't know if you guys have ever paid it that much attention, but when they set up the equipment to bring, you know, the water thing to bring back the powder back to people, there's actually devices sitting in those seats. And then when they come back, they're like not there anymore.
They're sitting on them. Yeah, you're not supposed to think about that, Drew. No, don't think like that's. I don't have a, you know, as much as that it does kind of bug me. I'm like, no, I don't really have as much of a problem with that. But hey, since you mentioned the vehicles, I did have a Batcopter when I was little, because from this movie, I've seen the actual Bat boat as well as many versions of the Batmobile. So those are exciting. But to me, when I rewatched, especially when I only watched it last night, the one vehicle that I'm like, this is outstanding, is the Penguin Sub. That thing is amazing. I love the sort of the duck feet or the penguin feet, like just kind of pedaling it around. Like, it looks so good. I just love it.
When the penguin periscope popped up for the first time during the movie, yesterday, the audience started laughing out loud, and it was fun because the audience's watching it with an audience like that on the big screen and just hearing their reactions to some of the movie, clapping and stuff like that, it was just fun. It was a good time.
What joke or what gag gets the biggest laugh? Is it the sometimes you get, some days you can't get rid of a bomb, or was it something else?
Yeah, that was it. The audience loved that.
Yeah.
So, and then there was a few other moments. I can't remember them all, but I just had fun with watching it and hearing the audience's reaction to everything.
More than anything else, too, I really just, when I was watching it last night, I was just paying attention to, you know, they've done it for a year, so they know. But, you know, the performances by, in particular, the villains, I just think, I love the fact that they go all in. They just, you know, you got guys like Cesar Romero, who's known as a, you know, Latin heartthrob. And here he is, just in his mannerisms, his walk, his movement of his hands, his, you know, flipping of the hair. Like, he just embodied, like, for me, that, for the longest time, that was what the Joker was. I just, he sold it so well. And even though Lee Merriweather's new to the part, I think she does a great job. And I do wonder if Julie Newmar was doing it, I sometimes wonder if she could have pulled off the Russian thing, accent, as well.
I don't think so.
Honestly, I love me some Julie Newmar. Don't get me wrong, but I think Lee kind of does a better job. Would have like he she does a great job selling the Kitka character.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
and but you know, Penguin and of course Burgess Meredith and Frank Gorshwin as the Riddler. I mean, they are all outstanding. They're fun to watch. They're fun to interact with. I get a thrill. I think even more so than when I watch Adam and Bert. I get a thrill out of watching the four of them interact because I could just watch them read the phone book, to be honest with you.
I really enjoyed that too. I especially liked when the Penguin is playing the Commodore and Batman and Robin are fully aware that it's obviously the Penguin.
Yes.
That in particular I thought was awesome. I really liked how, like you were talking about with Cesar Romero, with the things he was doing, I loved the little ticks that they would give their characters and kind of keep using those throughout the movie. Like the Riddler would keep kind of like biting on his finger. Yes. Those sorts of things are just I really liked, because it really just brought life to those guys.
Riddler in particular is so bloodthirsty. Really, yes. Bloodthirsty. You kind of understand later on where, like, Scott Snyder gets his ideas for the Riddler from, because the Frank Gorshin Riddler is just, like, it, you know, if you sort of look at just his lines, his delivery, even not so much his delivery, but the things he's saying, it's like, he really is psychotic.
Yes. One of my favorite reactions was when he essentially accidentally hits the dynamic duo in the Batcopter.
With that Polaris missile?
Where he's sort of like, oh, wait, I actually got them? Like,
yes.
That killed me. It was so good.
Now, I have to say, my youngest, he goes, the Riddler sounds more like the Joker with his laugh. I thought that was pretty funny.
I love, there's a sequence between the Riddler and the Joker where the Joker tells, like, they're telling the Riddler that he needs to send a message, that they need a ransom for this guy, but don't tell it in the form of a riddle, right? And so they're like, and obviously they could have anybody do this, but instead they're telling the Riddler to do it, but don't do it in the you know. And right before he leaves, the Riddler just looks at the Joker, and the Joker and he both share a laugh, and it's just beautiful. Like, it's just a beautiful moment between two very psychotic individuals.
Now, I have to say, Cesar Romero, you could definitely see that covered up mustache on the big screen.
Oh, sure. And especially, like, and I'm watching it in HD, so, you know, like, I'm like, really, I can, you know, there's no hiding that.
And oh man, you could see it pretty good.
It's charm at this point, though, right?
Yeah, I just had to laugh at him. And what it made me think of was Justice League and Superman. That's the first thing I thought of when I saw that.
I think Cesar Romero's has aged a little bit better, to be frank. One thing I thought was kind of, I got a kick out. It was one of those little small touches, was that when the villains would actually go commit a crime, they would all wear the little domino masks as if that would somehow conceal their identities.
Exactly. I'm like, what? Whose identity are they trying? Now, I can understand Catwoman, obviously, especially since she was trying to, hide the fact that she was Kitka, Miss Kitka or whatever, because you don't get that last shot, you know?
Right.
Adam West, whose face is already wet, you know, like almost in tears because his heart's broken, which I was a little disappointed. I'm like, oh, come on. Batman should have known from like the minute, you know, he couldn't pull one over on him. But nope, she did. But yes, I did find it funny that there were the other three. I'm like, you guys don't have secret identities. Why are you wearing masks?
Oh, my youngest. When Alfred was wearing his mask with his glasses over it, he's like, why? First he asked me, is Alfred wearing a mask under his glasses? I just laughed and said, yeah. We've seen him do it throughout the show before too, and I always find it hilarious because you can tell it's Alfred from his freaking glasses.
Yeah. I thought that, you know, usually in the show they have him dressed as Batman, which is hilarious in and of itself as well when he's wearing the cape and cowl.
Doesn't he usually wear his glasses on the outside of his on the Batman costume?
I think so. And, you know, because this is in, you know, HD and I'm sure on the big screen, you know, obviously with the fight sequences, you can really tell. And all the stunts, you can tell that it's not any of the main people.
Oh, like, yeah.
They don't do a very good job at hiding that at all.
The one you can tell the most is Robin.
Yes, because all of a sudden Robin grows like a foot tall. He's kind of beefier.
Yeah. And he's got, all of a sudden he has a man's face. even though most of the time it's pointed away from you, you can still tell.
Sure.
But yeah, and there was a couple of times I was like, wow, they used the stunt double for that scene, you know. I was surprised at some of the times I saw the stunt double doing scenes that I thought that the actors could do.
I actually was surprised at, like, there's some extensive fight sequences, particularly where Bruce Wayne takes on the four of them, like, and it's Adam. Like, you can tell that it's Adam fighting, like, three stuntmen, and I'm like, he's really in there fighting. That was pretty awesome.
Yeah. I bet that was just fun to do too. one of the things I like about this movie too is how much of the Batcave we get to see.
One of the biggest laughs I had is when Batman tells Robin to go punch the coordinates into the computer. Robin just smashes buttons.
He literally punches it. Like, it's like bam, 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 bam.
I mean, I don't know that they could have gone more out of their way to make it look less scientific than they did. It just killed me.
Oh, one of the things I have to bring up is the dust separator machine. I can't remember if it was my youngest or my other son that was with me, but one of them said they actually have a dust separating machine in the Batcave.
my favorite is in the beginning, you know, when Batman asks for the shark repellent spray. It's what's really hilarious about all of that is that not only do they have shark repellent spray on hand, but if you look, there's like three other bottles, one for Barracuda, one for Manta Ray, and one for something else. I can't remember.
Whale. Yeah. Whale repellent.
I was like, man, they are well stocked. So really, you know, since they are so well stocked, it's not really unheard of that they would have you know, shark. If they only had shark repellent spray, then that would be kind of hilarious. But they know they still have they have quite a library.
Okay. One of the things the audience was dying laughing about was the shark when it was on Batman's leg. And he keeps on pounding. You know, if a shark was really on his leg, he'd be chomping his leg off. But he's just, it goes on for, that sequence goes on for a while where he's just banging on the shark waiting for Robin to bring down that repellent.
Robin gingerly climbs down the ladder.
Look, I'm afraid of heights. I don't blame him. Because that ladder does not look secure, especially when you have a man near the bottom, like who's like being like who's beaten on a shark. That ladder's going all over the place. But I do like the acrobatic way in which he hands him the can, Mister. Right? Like I'm like, oh, look, they're using his Dick Grayson's acrobatics in here.
That might have been the most like Robin-esque thing I saw in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we only get like a minute of Dick Grayson. I don't think everything else it's Robin, right? I don't think we ever really see him as
it's very little. It's yeah. Very, very little.
Yeah.
One of the scenes I always find funny is when him and Alfred are in the park in the Batmobile. Oh, we can't watch this. And it makes such a big deal about not watching Bruce.
Well, it would be kind of creepy. Like I would be like, I would be uncomfortable too, you know.
that is very true, but I always find it funny. And then when he calls he has to call Commissioner Gordon and give him an update. What are they still doing in the park? Well, let's just say there's no criminal activity going on. And then Commissioner Gordon's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, something that Commissioner Gordon actually understands.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So, man, this movie is just hilarious.
It is really good. It's funny that a lot of the people from the show, like Aunt Harriet and Chief O'Hara, like show up in the movie. They don't do anything. So they're only there just kind of waving and being background material. But the fact that they're there is cool. You've got all the elements. It's kind of hard to sustain. You take that show and what really worked was the cliffhangers, you know, and then getting the cliffhangers resolved. And the movie kind of bumps around that. I mean, they do have the, within the show, they have, you know, within the movie, they do have some scenes of dire consequence, and then they get out of it. But I do find that, you know, if I have one criticism, it's the fact that the way that it's written, the way they get out of those is not very clever. And in fact, it's almost in your face, like, yeah, we don't have, it doesn't matter, like, how they get out of it. It's just stupid.
So would the shows end on cliffhangers?
Oh, yeah, you haven't seen the show?
I've not seen many.
Okay, so when the series was first, the first season, it would air twice a week. So it would air, I think, on Thursdays and on Fridays. And the first half hour would end in a cliffhanger so that people would have to watch it on Friday to see how it was resolved. And so they would come up with these elaborately cool cliffhangers like that they would be put into every other episode. And it was just fantastic. And I tell you, even watching them in syndication, because sometimes they didn't air them in order. You know, sometimes you'd see a cliffhanger and the next time you got to watch it, you'd be like, well, how did they get out of it? And there are cliffhangers that for like decades, I didn't know how they escaped. yeah, so it was really, I mean, I'm a big fan of cliffhanger type television, or stories. So I just ate that stuff up, and it might be because my love for that might have come from this show in the beginning. I don't know. It was such an early age, but I just really thought that the cliffhangers they did on a regular basis, they did that in season two as well. Season three, they switched. They only were aired, I think, once a week. So they kind of, and they didn't tell multi-part stories very often. So you don't have the cliffhangers as much. And it kind of, season three is the weakest, even though season three is where they introduce Batgirl, which is kind of cool in and of itself. But The series is really good. The first episode, the first two episodes, the first two-parter is involving just the Riddler. He's the first villain that they face. And he actually kills someone. Someone dies. And it's the only time that that happens ever in the Batman 60s franchise. It's pretty crazy. But I would, I love the series. I love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. And the movie is really good. But, you know, ultimately it's not, it's like there are two parters of the series that are way better than this movie.
Following up on that, do you think that that's part of the reason why the movie just kind of ends a little bit? Because that's not normally how they did it.
Yeah, so I think so.
Really,
I
have a lot of practice, so to speak, with just ending a story.
I mean, obviously the stories had endings, but and you know, I think, I think certainly after that big climactic battle on the sub, on the outside of the sub, where everybody just goes in the water, and it kind of extends out where, you know, they're fighting in the water, and it just that whole sequence kind of goes on a little bit too long, and it's not really filmed in a way that's very, if you'll pardon the pun, dynamic. and so I think that lends itself to a kind of not very nice, like, and plus then, so you have this like extended fight sequence that's not that cool, and then you get the reveal that, you know, Kitka is Catwoman, and Bruce doesn't know, and I'm like, he should know. Like, you know, Robin should be the, even if he didn't know, he should play it off as if he knew. Like, just that right. would be funny in and of itself. But right. And then, you know, to go into, you know, to have the separation of the dust particles and then putting them back together, and then the ending where they're just kind of like sneaking out the back, it does kind of, it's not the best ending. You're right. I will concede that. Like, and that does kind of lend itself to maybe one of the reasons why, like I said, some of the two-parters in the TV series are much better than the movie.
Now, one thing I want to say, a lot of the I remember a lot of the shows always ending back at Wayne Manor.
Yes, in the TV series, quite frequently they would kind of end at Wayne Manor with the sort of like, well, Robin, this adventure, what did it teach you? You know, that kind of thing. So we don't really get that moment in this, you know. And with either Alfred or Aunt Harriet going, oh, you know, what are you two talking about? You know, wah, wah, that kind of thing. So.
Now, another thing I want to bring up, because it's my favorite episode and I watched it recently, it's a Julie Newmar episode from the series. Catwoman dies because she falls into this pit, or she's trying to keep hold of she's being greedy and wants to keep hold of the loot.
Yep.
And
yep.
ends up falling into that, well, they called it a bottomless pit, but.
Suppose, she comes back, though. She doesn't die.
Yeah. Well, they even say in that episode that Bruce is something about their cats having 9 lives, and they probably hadn't seen the last of her or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
There are some really amazing moments in the series. Some moments where you're like, whoa, I mean, definitely. There's one that opens with, I can't remember the exact. Yeah, sorry. But there's one that I remember. It begins with, I think, Commissioner Gordon getting shot. And you're like, whoa! Like, this is like, but it turns out that, you know, it's not, it's okay. But it was one of those things that kind of, like, surprised me. And some of the, like I said, some of the cliffhangers really were, the images of them were instilled in my little brain for decades. Like, there was a cliffhanger in one of them where Robin is fed to a huge oyster or clam. Yeah, it's a clam. And so it ends with kind of all you see are, like, you know, the clam shutting its mouth and Robin's little legs, like, just kind of like he's being engulfed by this thing. And as a kid, it was haunting. And for years, I never knew how he got out of that. I knew he got out, but I never knew how because I hadn't seen the second part.
We've talked about this before. Because I remember you talking about this before.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's like a rerun, right?
So the show had great cliffhangers. That's one of the things I loved about the show. And one of the reasons why I love cliffhangers so much, I know Cletus and I have talked about how I love cliffhangers before. One of the other things we see in this movie is President Lyndon B. Johnson. You don't actually see him, but...
No. But as Gordon says, I don't have to tell you who I just got off the phone with.
So many funny lines like that in this movie.
Yeah, there's a great, like I said, Lorenzo Semple Jr. is very good. I mean, at camp, I mean, there's a definite tone that they're all the actors are trying to play it as straight as they can. They go all in. They don't leave anything out, and I appreciate that because I think that, and I don't think they overdo it either. Because there's a fine line where you could really overdo it, and particularly when it comes to like someone like Frank Gorshwin. You would think that he's like, you know, he would upstage everybody, but he, you know, he still manages to reel it in and play off everybody as opposed to just trying to steal the scenes.
All right. Well, any last thoughts on the movie?
I'm glad I finally got to see the whole thing through. I very much enjoyed it.
That's cool. I would definitely say, you know, it's great fun. If you like the movie, then... You know, I would say it's not the best of the franchise, but it's a great way, even though it wasn't, it didn't come out first. Usually with these things, you know, the movie is the pilot or the movie, you know, in order to make money or to recoup some, they'll like string together four or five episodes and like say, call it a movie. You know, they did that a lot back then. But this is an original piece of work that, you're right, was released between the first and second season. But I think it serves as a great pilot so that if you watch the movie and you're like, this is really good and I like this, if you invest in the series, particularly that first season or two, there's some really, really good stuff ahead of you. I think it serves as a great introduction to the franchise, to the series even.
Yeah, I agree with that. And them doing it in between season one and season two, I think it helped boost its popularity back when it was airing.
Well, the movie didn't do well. The movie really didn't do that, not as well as they had hoped. I know that the studio was not happy with it. They were kind of worried about the whole thing, because I think originally they did want to put out a movie before the first episode of the series, and the studio was like, no, we're not doing that because we have no idea what, we're not going to invest in all that. So I think later on, as the series got really popular, I think, you know, they really re-released the movie in theaters, and I think it did better. And certainly since it was the only thing that was around that people could watch for a while, to see Adam and Bert, I think that it got a higher rating and ranking and did better. But it was a risk.
All right. Well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have any shout outs, Mike?
Well, I would like to obviously thank you again for the invite. It's always fun coming to this part of the ESO network station. Really like hanging out with you guys, talking DC talk. And of course, you can listen to me and Mike Faber talk about our nonsense every week at the earthstation1.com. Or you can also check out the books. And actually, Drew, I think I can announce it now. We do have a third volume of the ESO anthology, Tales of the Station, which will be released and available at Dragon Con. And for those people who are not going to be at Dragon Con on Labor Day weekend, they can order it online as well. And that we've got all the stories submitted, including yours. Thank you very much. I saw preliminary artwork on the cover today, and I'm very excited about that. So that is real. It's happening. So keep an eye out for more information about that.
My big question for you is, have you read my story yet?
No. So I have all the stories formatted, and they're being proofed. We're going through that process now, and so I will be reading it very soon. But I have been very busy trying to get Tiki Zombie done, And so that is my first order of business. And then, but I'm at a point now where it's in the hands of the artist. So now I can devote more and more time to reading the stories from the anthology and then getting that completed.
Awesome. I'm very excited about this story. So,
yeah, and you should be. You know, I read through, like I said, with everybody's, I kind of got them together and I read through like the first few pages or whatever. So, and everybody, like, it's great stuff. It's more and more great stuff. I think this will be, you know, dare I say, they get better and better as the volumes go on.
All right. Do you have any shout outs, Cletus?
Yeah, I mean, I usually mention it anytime we do anything with the Batman 66 universe. This is the comic I mentioned, but check out Batman 66, the comic. There's a whole bunch of tie-ins that they do. There's Batman 66 meets Wonder Woman 77, I think.
That was really good.
I've heard that that's the best one. I don't know. I've not read all of them, so I don't know for sure. But I found the comics of the series that I have read, I've really enjoyed. I think it can be a really nice sort of palate cleanser sometimes when you get some more serious Batman stuff. Every once in a while, you just kind of want a goofy Batman.
Right, and I've read some of that series too. It's great. It feels just like the show. All right, and for my shout out, a few episodes ago, Cletus and I talked about. On DC News, we talked about the 100-page giant exclusive comics that were coming out from Walmart. And I was able to get my hands on three of them. So I got the Batman giant, the Superman giant, and the Justice League of America giant. And I have to admit, they're pretty good. It's got one original story in it, and then the backup stories that they have in these, they pick some of the best stories I think in recent years for these.
Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run was hands down the best pick that they had. That was, I think, very smart on their part, because I think right now, I would say it's pretty safe to say most people picking this up are not the people they thought that would. Like, I think it's mostly comic book fans. Over time, I hope and suspect that they'll start drawing in more non-comic readers. And if they stumble into Geoff Johns' run, that's the sort of run that gets you into comics. That's what got me, like, really seriously into comics.
One of the things I was surprised at was the Terrifics being in the Superman giant.
I love that. I actually really like that, because I hope that helps keep that series going, because I am a huge fan of this, the Silver Age aesthetic that series has got going on.
I got to tell you, Cletus, when I read through the Superman giant, I reread the Terrific story, even though we just read it and reviewed it not too long ago. I still had to reread it, and I had a blast rereading it again. It's the stories they picked for these are just great. I'm really enjoying them, and you know me, I always get my stuff digitally, but it's been fun having this in my hand. Now, if I could only find the Teen Titans one. I got to tell the audience, I went to 7 Walmarts this weekend looking for the Teen Titans issue. Yeah, they're not putting that many copies out of these in each Walmart, and almost every Walmart I went to, there's only like 2 copies left of these giants. Like Cletus said, I have a feeling that comic book people are going and getting them, but if they're enjoying them like I'm enjoying them, I'm ready for the next ones already. And I really want that Teen Titans giant, because I know Tim Drake is in that Teen Titans group. So
it's your white whale.
I know. I'm gonna find that Teen Titans. I'm going back to I can tell you, Cletus, I'm going back to Walmart's later this week to see if they restock those. I really hope they do restock those before they put out, because I know once the new issues come out, they're gonna take the any leftover issues they have out there now, they'll probably pull them off the shelves and put in all issue number 2s when they come out next month.
Yep.
So I'm hoping they do restock them. But yeah, they every Walmart I went that had them, there was only like 2 issues left. And I was like, man, they've really sold out of these. So
awesome.
People are snagging them up. That's good. But I have a
My
feeling.
My hope is that they continue to sell well after the collectors stop snapping them up.
Yeah.
That's my hope.
Well, with this,
yeah, they're supposed to be targeted for a different audience to attract new readers.
Right. Yeah, I suspect that is not the majority that bought these first ones. So we'll see. We'll see. And I mean, they're selling either way. That's good for DC. But I hope it does achieve what it was intended to achieve, which is getting new people into these stories.
I can tell you when I was a kid and I was getting my comics off the newsstand, if I would have came across these, I would have been snagging these up. I can tell you that right now. And I think the stories they're putting in them are some of the best stories they could be putting in to bring in new readers. So I'm happy with them, that's for sure. Okay, Cletus, there was one other thing I wanted to talk to you about. Our friend Brandon from the bookstore, he likes to throw these scenarios together. So one of the things I told him I was going to see the Batman 66 movie next week, and one of the things he had to say is, what if Batman 66 was in the Frank Miller world? So we had a little short discussion about that tonight. I know he texted you about that, and you said that he'd die right away.
Yeah.
And I told Brandon to text you and tell him, I disagree with you, and now I'm going to tell you why I disagree with you. It's because Batman 66 is so silly that he gets out of things with stuff like shark repellent bat spray or birds flying in the way or something like that. So I imagined Bruce Wayne from Batman 66. I imagined him battling Superman and him pulling out some sort of gadget to take that Superman out or something like that. You know what I mean?
I can't disagree with that, but when I heard that, if you say it's in Frank Miller's world, I have to assume that Frank Miller is writing it. And I feel like Frank Miller would go out of his way to make sure that he died just to prove what an edgelord he is.
You know, taking it from your perspective, yes. But taking it from the perspective I had was, I thought about that. I was like, yeah, he probably would die pretty quickly in that world. Then I started thinking about it. But if he had the look of the Batman from Batman 66, he's always got some gadget, or there's always some sort of something that interferes that, oh, we are lucky this coincidence happened to save us. You know what I mean?
I can't disagree with that. I think it really, I mean, and of course, obviously, it always just comes down to whoever writes it. But really, it would come down to whoever actually was writing the story.
That is very true.
Because, yeah, because if it was written in the style of Batman 66, then yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. And that's funny. I mean, I would prefer to read that, to be honest with you, because I that's more my cup of tea.
So that would be actually pretty funny, seeing Batman 66, some of his goofy things that go on with him in the Frank Miller's world. You know, yeah. how many of the people in Frank Miller's world would be pissed at him?
Yeah.
And him skating through would just be funny.
Yeah.
All right, Brandon, so we talked about it, and there's your shout out to you. All right, well, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about this week, you can call our feedback line at 317-564-9133, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. Next week, we're going to be talking Superman number 1, Detective Comics number 984, Flash number 50, Plastic Man number 2, and honestly, I don't know what our main topic is going to be yet. Well, I thought about doing Batman Gotham by Gaslight, but we can't get any special guests on next week, so I'm going to prolong that one out a few weeks, see if we can get some guests to come back and talk about that. So what our main topic is, I don't know yet, so you guys can be surprised. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Comic Battery.
has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.